I love my job. Not many people are lucky enough to be able to say that and mean it, but I really do mean it. I love my job. I feel so happy to work for a place where the things I've wanted to do all my life, I get to do all the time. And I mean all the time, almost 24/7. The job is something I basically never leave. Because the job is to be myself. My name is Jason Scott, and this is the Jason Scott Talks His Way Out of It podcast. A huge thanks to Jeff Atwood and all the other patrons who have supported this podcast. So, I work for the Internet Archive in San Francisco, which is a nonprofit library and archive, and my title is Free Range Archivist. A title I made up myself when I was hired in 2011, and I'll talk about how I got hired a little later. But what I love about the Internet Archive is that it is top-down, dedicated to its mission, universal access to all knowledge. That's baked into the DNA. There isn't a secondary business that it's really pushing towards. There isn't any sort of corporate master pushing things in some strange direction. There isn't any kind of subterfuge that makes the place turn out to be doing the wrong thing while acting like it's doing the right thing. This has all become extremely precious and rare in the modern era. A lot of people react to the title Free Range Archivist, and they kind of wonder what it's about. And I'll tell you, it kind of goes like this. I wake up at various times in the morning and I go check my email, and in there are people asking me to help save things, or who think they have a pile of data and they want to know where to put it, or it's people who want to understand some process or how to start preserving something or researching something. And I write back to everyone about as fast as I can. Then I turn to various projects that are ongoing, some of them for years. Items like the Ted Nelson Junk Mail Project, where we've been scanning in tens of thousands of pages of junk mail that the pioneer Ted Nelson had kept in one of his storage units for a number of years. Or maybe it's something involving the hip hop mixtapes, where I've been pulling mixtapes from all sorts of RSS feeds of torrents for a little more than 2 years. Maybe it's something involving grabbing stuff from the output of archive team and making sure that it gets placed into the archive's digital storehouse in some sort of dependable manner. Maybe it's pushing a few collections around to make them make more sense, or maybe making a new collection of items to put them in there. It's all very fun if you're the kind of person who endlessly likes sorting things, which I am. In fact, it's kind of strange how if you're lucky enough to have a job that feeds into your weird obsessions. If you keep a good balance and you don't let it take over your personality and make it the full expression of who you are, it's a really unique experience. And it's one that I've never really grown tired of. Over the years, I've watched how the organization runs, and I've experienced ups and downs within the group as we try to deal with outside problems or internal disagreements. But just fundamentally, the bedrock of the Internet Archive is saving and providing information to anybody who wants it for as long as possible, preferably forever. Now, if you've listened to my speeches before, you've probably heard a lot about the Internet Archive, and everything I've said so far is pretty much run-of-the-mill. So I'm going to assume that you have listened to those kind of talks, and instead I'm going to go a little deeper to stuff I really can't do in a 30 or 40-minute presentation. So to understand life at the Archive, understand that it's the brainchild of a single person, and that person is Brewster Kahle. He is an MIT grad who, in the early 80s, went to work for a computer company called Thinking Machines, and then moved on into software and, more importantly, the collating and retrieval of information. He did this throughout the late 80s and into the early 90s and created a series of companies that did things involving gathering information or understanding online resources and making them easier to get to. Not quite a search engine per se, but something rather similar. After he sold the companies, he found himself with a large amount of money. Now, like a lot of people who have a lot of money, he doesn't really obsess about having a lot of money. Me, as a person who doesn't have as much money, obsesses about him having a lot of money. But what's interesting to me is that he got a windfall, a once-in-a-lifetime windfall of money. And it's always a very interesting character insight as to what a person does when they find themselves no longer worrying about most of the points in Maslow's pyramid. And what Brewster did was he turned around and said, I think I'd like to run a library. And not just a library, but I want to bring back the famed Library of Alexandria and bring back the library that's most famous for burning and make it available to the world again. And I gotta say, that's quite a pitch. There's no sense to pull names into it, but it's not that hard to find stories of people who became, in various ways, internet millionaires or multimillionaires, who have then gone on to be horrible people. People who took their money and just used it to buy other companies or used it to invest in various angel funding startups. I mean, nothing makes me sadder when the first line of a person's bio is angel investor, which just means people beg me for money all day and I give them some so that they can fill an office for 8 months. I'm not really a fan of a lot of Silicon Valley culture. It's not the place I like to be, which is part of why I work remotely. I just couldn't see myself in a place that really kind of turns everything into a transaction and looks at everything that a human life is and tries to codify it into some sort of online transaction with a small but important fee being taken out each time. I can't think of anything worse, actually. And so I latch on to the exceptional stories, the stories of where somebody made a lot of money and then proceeded to do something not just good, but great, and not just important, but vitally important. At this point, the Wayback Machine, which is, you know, the number one thing people know the archive for, it's a service and utility that many people think is actually government-funded because it plays such an important role in the internet. The ability to bring up web pages from up to 20 years ago and play them back is just a miracle, and it's a miracle happening every day. Anyway, like I said, a lot of this is happening under Brewster's dream, Brewster's hope, Brewster's interests, and so the archive has a very strong personality aspect to it. And you might think that might be a problem, but he's opened up doors that have enabled things to really expand in directions that I'm sure he never envisioned. I'm sure if you told him that he would be one of the top spots for new hip-hop mixtapes, or that he would become one of the centers for emulated playing online, or any of the hundreds of other things the place is being used for, he would have had no idea. So there's this building, this renovated church that sits in the middle of San Francisco, and it's the place that has 33 petabytes, or thereabouts, of the Internet Archive. People often ask me, like, how much space do you have to play with? And way too much. And I just tend to go, enough. Enough. I have enough to do what I need to do. If I see something and it's something like 300 gigabytes and I have to download it because it might go away, I don't even think about it. 300 gigabytes comes in, 300 gigabytes goes up to the Internet Archive. I have people who come to me with collections of things like scanned books or photographs or video, and they'll say to me, I'm really worried. It's something like 4 or 5 gigabytes. And I'll be like, I uploaded 400 gigabytes by mistake yesterday. Yeah, we'll find a place for it. We can hold it. Brewster's vision is to bring in as much data as possible and provide as much data as possible, which he shortens as bits in, bits out. And what that means is that if we have people contributing important culture and artifacts of a digital nature onto the archive, and we have people out there who are trying to find something or are browsing or just having fun, and they're able to get all of that data, that's the primary goal of the Internet Archive. It's a place where items that maybe don't have an easy home or can't find the kind of sponsors that would enable it to be hosted somewhere finds a home. But I'll tell you my internal name for it, the nickname that I've given the entire project, and that's Brewster's Magnificent Contraption. because in many ways, the Internet Archive is a contraption. Let's be clear here. I mean, it's a place where there's a lot of improvisation. There's a lot of solutions that have been tried, and some have worked really well and some have worked okay. And it's an ongoing experiment instead of trying to portray itself as some sort of finished ironclad machine with rigid structure and procedures and very little ways to be able to improvise if something strange or new or odd happens. Something strange and new and odd happens at the Internet Archive every day. The kind of things that go by when people are discussing a problem, whether it's a machine that's gotten overheated or a user that's coming to ask if they can upload a million items or finding out that we have now become the owners of an entire record store's back inventory and we have to store it somewhere in our warehouse. I mean, every day is weird and interesting and fun and a case of trying to figure out how to stay just a little ahead of technical obsolescence and a tidal wave of incoming information. I like that. I like that because everybody at the archive, from the people who work in the front office, to the folks who work in the accounting department, to the people who work in our physical archive or work in the collections team, the development team, all these people are all focused towards the dream, the goal, the idea. If there's arguments, the arguments are over how to do it better. If there are any raised voices, it's in defense of doing the right thing. And if there's any misunderstandings, it's two people who are both trying to achieve the really great goal and finding that they have different ways that they would achieve it. That is not a situation I had in my previous career as a Unix admin, where I worked for a company that had bought two other companies that themselves had bought another company that I worked for. That company changing name 5 times. If it sounds weird and boring, it was. Except for the thing with the CEO and the strip clubs, but I'll get back to that later. I've been asked a bunch of times how I got my job at the Internet Archive, and it's one of those cases of, I'll tell you, but I don't think it'll help you. Sometimes people want to work there or they want hints or something. I don't know if my way really works for everybody, but here we go. So I was working at this other firm, and I was, like I said, a Unix admin. And for some time, they had been looking to get rid of me. My job as a Unix admin was to work for a small handful of customers who were rather lucrative, and my job was to do any sort of Unix work they needed. It was kind of like a Unix concierge. I was on call for 10 straight years. Everything from changing out disk drives to coming up with new backup systems to designing a new operating system partition layout for whatever new application they were coming up with. You know, basically anything they wanted. It was like having another employee somewhere for companies that just didn't want to pay to have their own machines administered. And when I had started at that company in 1997, we had something like 14 or 15 customers, and they were very lucrative. But over time, they had either gone to different cheaper hosting solutions or had gone out of business. And by the time we got to 2009, I was pretty much working with about 3 customers. Now, the company I was working for wanted to fire me, but you can't just fire somebody without causing a stink, so they needed to build up a case to get rid of me. Now, before you jump to conclusions, it's just a case that when I had worked for my previous company, my salary had risen at a certain amount, and when the company that bought my company looked at all the salaries, I was making 3 times as much as one of their managers. They just had a lower pay scale, and I was way too expensive, and they wanted me out of there. And there's a bunch of ways they could have laid me off, but the problem was that the main customer, who was making quite a bit of money, had made it very clear that if the company was to lay me off, that they would leave, and there would go a few million a year. So things were in kind of a stasis for a while. I was expensive, but I was being covered. But eventually, my favorite customer made it pretty clear that they were moving on and they were going to go to their own cheaper hosting. So I knew the writing was on the wall. It started out pretty simple. My company wrote a pretty fraudulent end-of-year assessment of my skills. It was written by somebody who had never met me, and it was a 2-page description of how terrible I was at my job, that I lacked the ability to work with my coworkers, that I was coming in at bad hours and not putting in the work. You know, basically a litany to indicate that I was the world's worst employee, with a recommendation that I should be assessed. Through what method? Not made clear. And I knew what was going on, so when I signed it, I signed with a 2-page signing statement that indicated, I know what you're trying to do here. But they did it. It was a nice way to have a fig leaf if there was ever a lawsuit. Eventually, my customer left. We shook hands and off they went. And I knew it was just a matter of time. But to give you an idea of how screwed things were with this company, the person whose job was to fire me had to do it in person, which meant that this person who I basically never dealt with told me they really needed to have a meeting with me in about a month. I was fine with it. Again, I knew it was happening. When the person showed up, he called me into an office and he immediately began to lay me off. Now, I tweeted about it. Actually, if you go look in my tweets, I can describe being laid off. I can describe what's happening. And of course, I immediately texted my coworkers. I told them I was being laid off and what my severance package was and everything else. I was concerned for them, but this was mostly a chance to get rid of me. And what I find most interesting at the time in this conference room where I was being laid off was the fact that I was just actively using my phone while he was talking and he made no move. I'm saying it pretty lightly, but I was pretty sad because I had been doing Unix administration for roughly 15 years and I was tired. I didn't want it. And that meant that when I looked back at what I had done there, all I had done was keep a bunch of machines running. And that's sad. And the worst part is, having been laid off, my initial idea might be to go back into Unix administration with another company, maybe a company that wasn't even as nice or pleasant in terms of the working environment, just to draw another salary where I take care of machines and make sure they go down as little as possible. I didn't want that. So I launched a Kickstarter, and this was one of the first Kickstarters in that time, which basically asked people to help fund a sabbatical, where I would finish my documentary on text adventures and then look for a job or employment that was something more in tune with where my interests and talents were. And bless them, people gave money towards that Kickstarter, and I really did finish the documentary, and I really did go out and try to find a better place to work. So that put me in California in 2011, where I had finished both releasing the GitLamp documentary and doing a tour related to it and generally wanting to move on. And I was looking around for just the right place. And I had heard about the Internet Archive, like a lot of people, as a series of either the name or the Wayback Machine or occasionally a project that they were involved in, or going there and being blown away by how much stuff was online, how I could download a 500 megabyte movie file and realize that it was just one of thousands in just one collection of thousands of collections. But besides all that, it was also a place that hosted other conferences. And one of those conferences was something called PDA 2011, the Personal Digital Archiving Conference. I'd flown to San Francisco, and I walked into this unique building with its columns and its high ceilings, and went up the stairs into what's known as the Great Room. Now, if you're somebody who's listening to this podcast and you've never heard of the Great Room of the Internet Archive, it helps to understand just how weird the Internet Archive 300 Funston Avenue building is. It serves as the headquarters of the Internet Archive. Many of the machines are hosted there, and it is a renovated Christian Science church. When Brewster bought it, he bought it because it looked like his logo. That was the sum total of what really attracted him to it. It was not designed to have a data center in it. It was not designed for offices. It wasn't designed for anything except for to be a church. So in all of the renovations that happened, the church still looked like a church, but it also had servers all over the place, and it also had offices in what used to be the Sunday school. It was an odd-ass building. And when you first go up the stairs and walk into the Great Room, the first thing that blows you away is the sheer size of it. It's a room that's designed to be able to hold hundreds of people, and it's got a stage and a pipe organ. And then the second thing that you notice are all the little people. By that I mean there are over 100 small clay figurines indicating various people who have worked at the archive for 3 years. If you work there for 3 years, they build a little statue of you. And these creepy little suckers are everywhere in the Great Room. They look very modern and yet also very ancient. So you walk along these creepy little statues and you sit down on an actual church pew. And then, in my case, a conference is going on involving digital archiving. And I was scheduled to speak, and the speech that I gave, which was about the work I had done with Archive Team and saving things, was very specifically designed. It was designed to be fun and impressive and loud and really rouse the troops about what a great thing it was to save websites that were going away. And it landed well. It was a relatively small audience, a few dozen people, but it landed pretty well, including with Brewster, who was in the front row. And after I gave my speech, I went downstairs into the Sunday school of the archive, which, like I said, is now offices. And I just went to a bunch of people who all looked like they ran things and said to them, "Hi, my name's Jason, and you should hire me." And I did this over and over again. I saw Sam, I saw Alexis, I saw June. Everybody I saw, I would walk up to and go, "Hi, I'm Jason Scott. You should hire me." And I remember very specifically at the post-conference get-together, Brewster being there and me saying to Brewster, "Hi there, Brewster. I'm glad you liked the speech. I'd like you to hire me." And Brewster saying, "Yeah, that sounds like a pretty good idea." Now, I didn't burst into tears right there, but I definitely felt the earth move, and I definitely felt the universe shift for me, because the chance to work there seemed like the final piece locking into a puzzle that I didn't even know I was assembling with my life. And so when I was able to announce that I was going to work for the Internet Archive, my absolute favorite response that I got from a lot of people was, "I thought you were already working for them." And you know, it feels like that so often. It just feels like, where else would I be? I really do love my job. I'm sure in later episodes I'll go deep into this particular event or how things were being done on the archive side or some weird specific piece of tech and how it functions and why it grew to be what it was. But for now, let me just say that if you're somebody who is in a job that you hate, or where you realize that nothing about the company is inspiring you or making you feel like you're part of something greater and making the world better, but please don't settle into thinking that it's you, that you did something wrong and you deserve to not enjoy what you're doing and that it's about a paycheck, because it's something that rots you inside. But at some point, you wake up and you wake up unpleasantly. And I'd rather you did that sooner rather than later and move on to your dream job, where you wake up every morning excited to see what's going to come in and going to bed at night happy at what just happened. And maybe you'll end up at a place where, like me, they built a statue of you after 3 years. Hey, so actually I should really tell you about that strip club thing. Let me tell you about this. So, in New York City, there is a strip club named Scores, and Scores has been around for quite some time, and it has been rife with all sorts of weirdness and scandals, but let's hearken back, shall we, to the early 2000s. The dot boom has happened, but it's now the dot bust, and there's still stupid stuff going on because the tech industry is stupid. And if you're running some sort of company where you have sales and macho guys and everything else, maybe there's going to be a night when you and your little salesman pals think it's a great idea to go to a strip club to celebrate. And if you're in New York City, naturally you might want to go to one of the more established strip clubs like, say, Scores. Now, Scores had an interesting policy in place, and let me try to classify this as just saying I'm not going to really say anything explicit or awful. It's not like that. But Scores closed at 11 o'clock at night. And you say to yourself, that's really strange, Jason. Why would a strip club close that early? Wouldn't the clientele want to stay up all night? And the answer is, of course they would. But you see, Scores would close at 11, but then stay open. And anybody who was in the club, especially somebody who went into one of the special rooms in the back, they were keeping the club open. I'm making air quotes here. They were keeping the club open, and you were paying a fee for that. You were paying an overtime fee for that. And of course, if you wanted ladies in your room, there was an overtime fee per lady per hour. And if you wanted champagne, well, the bottle service was going to cost you money. And again, it's past 11. The club is closed. It's more money for bottle service per bottle per hour. And so on. If this sounds like a scam, you said it, I didn't. So apparently, it was very easy to rack up very large numbers at Scores, especially if you stayed until the wee hours of the morning. With all of your girls, all of your overpriced champagne, and all of, once again, the stupidity of being a CEO with your salespeople celebrating a wonderful accomplishment at a strip club. So sometime later, the bill came in on the American Express card of the CEO, and it was for $210,000. This is a lot of money. And the CEO thought it was too much money. And the club claimed that it wasn't too much money. So, naturally, a lawsuit happened. That lawsuit went on for a little over a year and was quietly going on in the background while lawyers argued with other lawyers about what things cost. The CEO's lawyer claimed that at most, it couldn't have been more than $20,000. And if it sounds to you a little strange that $20,000 is suddenly a reasonable amount to spend in a night in a strip club, well, you know, join the club. But not this club. And certainly not after hours. So the court case went through and they settled, and it was definitely a five-figure sum instead of a six-figure sum. So I guess hooray for legal fights. And it all would have just happened in the background. But somebody... And there was a lot of speculation around the company water cooler about who did this. Somebody called in a tip to the New York Daily News to say, maybe you should go look at this court case that just got settled in this New York court. So they did. And suddenly there was my CEO of my company on the front page of the papers. I remember one headline being Lap Dunce. Not bad. And throughout it, of course, the CEO and his wife said, look, it was only $20,000. It wasn't $210,000. I don't know what they were thinking. So within some time, my CEO was gone. And here's the thing, right? Throughout that, my company continued to function. I mean, we all did our jobs. We met with our customers. We did technical work for them. We made plans for the next year. We assured them that their backups were working. We did all the boring things a job does while never really addressing that our CEO had been essentially fired for paying tens of thousands of dollars to strippers with our sales team. And the only lesson I can think of here is the human mind can absorb anything. Literally the six impossible things before breakfast. I look back on it now as this strange kind of hypnosis that it was just about getting the job done, getting my nice salary, going home, and spending the money. And I'll leave that with a thought that came to me from a friend. And what he said to me was, it wasn't hard to walk away from his old life. Because as he put it, at night I was on Amazon, all night, buying things to convince myself I was free. Are you trying to convince yourself that you're free? This is the Jason Scott Talks His Way Out of It podcast. My name is Jason Scott. Thank you so much for listening. A huge thanks to the supporters at the $50 level, which includes James Bacoyano, Sam Johnson, Astrid Smith, and Kevin Waters. This podcast is being used to raise funds to pay off debts and other commitments I've had over the years, and it's going extremely well. Thanks again to everybody. Talk to you next week.